다시는 대시구 대행의 벽에 나아리하다.
So next I'll say Tibetan. The praise to the mother of the Buddha, the perfection of wisdom. And then say the recite the mantra of Heart Sutra.
시르니 바로 드실베 배정어도 이런 바 아니 자복을
And also there's a verse of salutation from Abhisamaya Alankara. By Maitreya, which is a commentary to the implicit content of the Perfection Wisdom Sutras. And then Master also recite the verses of salutation from Mulamayamaka Karika of Master Nagarjuna, who has commented or explained the Panchaparamita Sutras, the explicit content of it. This is homage to the Buddha, mother of all the Buddhas, the perfection of wisdom. Gate para, gate para, sangate bodhi swaha, te atha, gate, gate para, sangate bodhi swaha. Dayatha gate gate para gate para sangate bodhi swaha. Then this is the verse of salutation from Abhisamaya Alankara by Lord Maitreya. I prostrate the mother of the Buddhas and of the hearers and bodhisattvas who, through the knowledge of all, he leads hearers seeking pacification to perfect peace, who, through knowledge of paths, causes those helping migrators to achieve the aims of the world, and through possession of which the subduers such set forth the varieties of teaching and all aspects. And verses of salutation from Mula Madhyamaka Karika of Arya Nagarjuna. I prostrate to the perfect Buddha, the best of teachers, who taught that whatever is dependently arisen is unceasing, unborn, not annihilated, impermanent, not coming, not going, without distinction, without identity, and free from conceptual constructions and peaceful. I prostrate to the Gautama, who, out of his compassion, taught the holy Dharma to rid us of all distorted views. So, in this world, there are many different religious traditions. For the last 4,000 years, these religious traditions started. And Buddhism is one of them. Buddha Shakyamuni, the Bhagwan, popular account, he lived around 2,600 years ago. So, even after 2,600 years, Buddhism is still one of the major religious traditions of the world. Regarding Buddhism, During the time of the Buddha himself, he gave the teachings, sermons, in what is known as the common people's language, Prakrit. So he was taught, said to have given teachings in that language. And later on, these teachings that he gave were compiled into the three Tripitakas, which we find also in the Pali tradition. So the Pali Tripitaka becomes the fundamental teaching of the Buddha. And then Buddha also gave certain teachings to people who have pure karma, such as this Prajaparamita Sutras, which we find in Sanskrit, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So in any case, the Pali the teachings that we find in Pali tradition are fundamental and the broad framework of Buddhism, in which we have the teachings on the Four Noble Truths and then also the 37 harmonies to enlightenment. And then with regard to Mahayana teachings, the teachings teach about the Bodhisattva paths and grounds, And in these teachings, the true cessation and the means to achieve that true cessation, that true path, are taught in greater detail. So chronologically, we have first the Pali tradition, the Pali teachings of the Buddha, and therefore the monks from Thailand and Laos, Laos. So the monks who have come from Thailand and Thailand and Laos. So the monks from Thailand and Laos.
As monks rule, firstly.
So Nangbe the Gindunbe do Tim Shishachavina. Do I Shishachavina? Can answer Lava Devaris.
You understand English, of course. So historically, we are junior. You are senior. So I must respect. Then, in Sanskrit tradition, I think first from Sanskrit to Chinese translation. That I think third century, fourth century. In Tibet, only around seventh century, then mainly eighth century. So again, we are junior. So whenever I give some teaching to the Chinese Buddhist, I always pay my respect to Chinese Buddhist. Meantime, I also, you see, mentioning as far as serious study, firstly, the root text, memorize, learn by memorize, several hundred pages. Then each word explain with help of commentary. Then again, you see, through dialectical sort of debate, try to understand precisely each word meaning, precise sort of meaning through debate. So it seems, I think, junior Buddhist student, Tibetan, I think our tradition seems to say much more rigorous study. In order to sort of say reach the high degree, I think 20, 30 years you have to study. And I think the volumes, at least 30, 40, 50 volumes, we have to study like that. So in any way, I, as a Buddhist monk, I feel great honor, you see, to have this opportunity to share about Buddha's teaching with other Buddhist brothers, sisters. I'm extremely happy, great honor. Then now it's a Tibetan.
So let's have tea first. Grace for the tea. Some jav, legend, some jav. Inconceivable is the Buddha, inconceivable is the Dharma, inconceivable is the Sangha. I give this offering to the three inconceivables, and the fruit of this would be something inconceivable.
Okay. Then, breath of water, hot water, water, cold water. Then, you go to the two tongue.
What?
We didn't get cups.
So in recent times, I've started giving teaching only in the mornings, and then in the afternoon, so that I can and I have other things to do and also take some rest. So otherwise, if I teach in the morning and then also in the afternoon, sometimes I feel exhausted, almost exhausted. And so I'm going to give teaching only in the morning. So those who have come before, please raise your hands.
Okay.
And those who are here for the first time, please raise your hands. People from Thailand?
No, lay people.
Oh, those Thai people. Raise hand. Oh, one there. Oh, say. Okay. Any Laos? Laotian? Laos? Only monk. Monk. Four monks. Yeah. Then Singaporean, raise hand. Oh yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. And then some Malaysian. Oh, right. Good. Then some Hong Kong, from Hong Kong. Oh yeah. Okay. Then some Indonesian. Okay. That's your Oh, some Vietnamese. Oh yeah, Vietnamese, right. Oh yeah. Tadaro. Into the diesel, into the pendulum. I'm gonna forget. Some Korean there. Korean. Oh, Korean. Right. Some Vietnamese. Then Spanish speaking. Oh yeah. Okay. So then most of the English speaking there, isn't it? Right. Thank you. Buddhism historically belongs to Asia. So Asian religion, one of the Asian religion. However, now in the modern time, the world become much smaller. The information reach everywhere. So people from West, traditionally non-Buddhist country, but there are number of people who really showing interest about Buddha Dharma. Like in Asia, number of the Christians, the Muslims. Buddhism, like Christian or Islam, and Judaism, Buddhism also become like the world religion, one of the important world religion. Okay. Now,
So the Buddha. Buddha's come into the world and give teachings. So coming to the world and then giving teachings. Having given teachings, the Buddha's teaching still even today is alive. So the Buddha's come into the world and give the teachings, which is good, and then harmony among the Sangha is also a source of happiness. And so whether we are followers of the Pali tradition or Sanskrit tradition, we are all followers of the same teacher, the followers of the same teacher, the Buddha. And therefore, we need to become familiar with each other by knowing each other and have good contact with each other. This is very important. Sometimes, from my own experience, I have good contact with it, and it seems that I have better contact with Christians. And I feel that we have less contact amongst the Buddhists ourselves. So, of course, this connection between the Buddhists is increasing and become better. And so, as the quotation says, the harmony among Sangha is happiness. So we follow this Vinaya tradition. So there were the four original principal orders of Vinaya, and which in later divided into 18 branches. So we have Pratimoksha practice in Sanskrit. According to the Sanskrit Pratimoksha, we have 253 vows for fully ordained Manga Bhikshu. And then in the Pali tradition, we have over 200 something vows for the Bhikshus. So it's a difference in the number. The biggest difference is in the misdeeds, the category of misdeeds. In the Pali tradition, there are 77 of them, whereas in the Sanskrit tradition, there are 112. So it's a minor difference, actually, between these two. So, in the case of the Sanskrit tradition, with regard to how to wear the robes, there are 7 points mentioned. So, misdeeds which can be committed in relation to the lower garment of monks, there are 7, whereas in the Pali tradition, there is mention of only 1, which is in Pali tradition, it says that the monk's robes should be worn properly. And then we have the 4 Parajikas, and then the 13 Sanghas, the and so forth, which are all same. So we have, of course, different Vinaya traditions, but we are all the same follower of the same Buddha, the teacher. And therefore, it's very important for us to be in harmony with each other, especially in today's world. So whether we are followers of Pali or Sanskrit traditions, we should be friendly and we should know each other well and be in harmony. And so today, the bhikshus from monks from Pali tradition, I would like to thank you especially for coming here, and I welcome you. So the Buddha, the Blessed One, regarding his teaching, there are two. It's twofold. One is the scriptural, comprising the Pitaka, and then the other one is the realization, the experience, which are the three trainings. And fundamental to these three is the practice of morality, the training of morality. And Buddha himself has said, where a place where there is the practice of the three monastic practices, Buddha would not be worried about the teaching being alive. And so in the Pratimoksha Sutra, the Buddha has said, after my death, this is your teacher. So this will be my representative, the Pathamoksha Sutras. So this is like Buddha's own final will. So the Pathamoksha is like his the representative of the Buddha's body and speech. So the fundamental to our realization of the Dharma is the Vinaya practice, the practice of morality. One time, I was in the World Parliament of Religions, in where I met some Burmese monks, Burmese bhikshus. So I had some discussion about Vinaya, and they were very pleased and said that, asked me, do you Tibetans also have such practice? And so they came to know that we have the same practice of Vinaya. So otherwise, some people get the idea that Tibetan Buddhism is something to do with the deities and then this ritual dance and so forth, and that we don't have Vinaya practice. This is not true. Not at all. And so, as the Buddha has said, harmony amongst the Sangha is the source of happiness. And so the harmony should come on the basis of a practice of the Vinaya, the monastic discipline. So there are some differences, but basically it's same. The same with regard to how to get ordained and how to keep one's vows and how to rectify if you go against the vows. So these are all same. And sometimes we use the term Mahayana. In Mahayana Sutra, Alamkara of Maitreya, there is mention of Mahayana and Hinayana. So when we use the term Hinayana, it's not denigrating, they are looking down upon the tradition as such. But it's talking about the difference in the vast and extensive practice of the six paramitas and so forth. And so we are not despising the tradition. When we use the term Hinayana, it's not a denigrating term. And this, because in according to Tantra, it is even said that if you despise the Hinayana teachings, then it's a fault of the bodhisattvas. They go against their vow and commit some infraction. And therefore, we need to respect all the traditions of the following the Buddha, and especially the Theravada teachings. Where you have the Vinaya practice, which is fundamental to the practice of Buddhism. Without the Vinaya, the basic practice of Vinaya, the moral precepts, you cannot go about with the Mahayana practice. And then we have the basic teachings of the Four Noble Truths. And on top of that, when we come to identify the true cessation, since it is its quality that you attain by overcoming all the defilements in your mind, and therefore you need also to understand the antidote to overcome these negative emotions. And therefore we find very detailed explanation of emptiness in the Perfection of Wisdom teachings. And so in the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, the final two truths, the truth of cessation and truth of path, are especially emphasized and explained in great detail, and also the truth of suffering and the origin of suffering as well. So in the Sanskrit tradition, we find them written in great detail. So Buddhadasa Bhikkhu of Thailand.
Buddhadasa. Do you know Buddhadasa? Late Buddhadasa. Once I have been, you see, his place, and I really sort of very much impressed where he gives some teaching on some big trees. Big trees, and just stone, I think, small sort of seed. When I saw that, I felt, Buddha's time, Buddha himself, I think, give teaching that way. Not like this kind of seed. Sometimes we follow of Buddha. Sometimes we say acting greater than Buddha himself. I think that is rubbish. Really rubbish, I think. So Buddhadasa, once I met, one time I met, you see, he really showing interest about Shunyata, Anatma theory, Anatma, and Shunyata, like that. So in any way, Kanda Adadi, Chuksananda, Chasaka, Lekjag Shungi, Tao, Tenshi, Ta Namja Choki, Tambani, Ta Kanda, any, Kanda Dunga Tembe,
they teach the the Sanskrit literature teach the selflessness and emptiness in great detail, and wish to share this with you. In the Heart Sutra, we find mention of the five aggregates also are empty of intrinsic existence. And so that regarding that term also, it is found in Tibetan. And then in the original Sanskrit Heart Sutra, so there is also this word is also there, but in the Chinese it's not there. This word also has great significance. There are two different ways we can understand it. When the Buddha taught the Heart Sutra, not only the person are empty of intrinsic nature, but also it means that the five aggregates, the psychophysical aggregates, on the basis of which we designate a person, they are also empty of intrinsic existence. And then, on another level, when the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha taught the suffering, which we do not want, and then the origin of suffering, and also the total pacification of suffering and its means. And so when he taught, gave these teachings, he didn't mention the person as such, I or person. And then when he elaborated on the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha gave the teaching on the 12 links of dependent origination. And within that teaching also, he taught that how we enter into samsara, beginning with ignorance and the nature of samsara and suffering. And the Buddha didn't mention the person So he didn't talk about an I or self. because this is to this is because the fundamental to Buddhist teaching of the Buddha is selflessness. And so he didn't mention the person as such, but he mentions the psychophysical aggregates. So whether we call it the identitylessness of persons or selflessness of persons, so the Buddha, with in order to think, in order to with the intention to teach this selflessness, so he taught that, that there is no such thing as independent self, but then there is some kind of indication of having the Buddha teaching that there are the aggregates. And so during the first turning of the Wheel of Dharma, the Buddha gave teaching on selflessness of persons. And then in during the second turning of the Wheel of the Dharma, then he not only taught selflessness of persons, but also selflessness of other phenomena. And so perhaps the word also in the Heart Sutra has that kind of connotation. And so, of course, I'm not. I do not have the courage to tell the Chinese that you have to change your translation and include this word. But what I mean is that if you have the words also there, then it has greatest meaning. So, in general, all the religious traditions of the world. The followers of the traditions, these different traditions, should have a friendly attitude towards, feeling towards each other. We should be harmonious with each other. If these religious traditions themselves create more discord amongst people, dividing us between us and they, if the religious traditions add to that, this is not right, and this is not needed. It's not worth to have this kind of discord, create this kind of discord, because all the religious traditions teach us to be good people, and how to be moral, and how to be altruistic. And so genuine practitioners of these traditions who sincerely practice their faith, we can see how they help other people, how they benefit, like in the case of Christian brothers and sisters. And then there are others also. So the essence or the essential message of these traditions is to help others and not harm them. And so since they teach this message, have this message, and in order to be practical about it, then we have the different philosophical views of these religious traditions as well. And therefore, we should acknowledge the help and the benefit of these religious traditions and pay respect to them, which is worthy to do. So if we don't have friendliness, harmony, then we can see how people kill each other. Even amongst the same followers of Islam, there is this killing between the Shiite and the Sunnis. And then in Sri Lanka, there was fighting between the Hindus and Buddhists. And also in recent times in Burma, there has been some conflict between Buddhists and Muslims. So these are very sad situations, sad things that have happened in the world. So we have to... The religious traditions themselves are helpful and beneficial to their own followers, and so we have to acknowledge that and accept this fact. So with regard to one truth and one religion, all religions teach that, of course, but this has to do with the individual practitioners of the respective religions. So in order to have a very firm and unwavering faith in one's own faith, we have this idea of one truth and one religion. But when it comes to the community, when we talk about humanity as a whole, this is not practical. One religion and one truth is not practical and it's not relevant. So for thousands of years, the reality has been that there has been all these different religious traditions and different truths, multiple truths. So in terms of humanity as a whole, we have to acknowledge multiple religion, multiple truths. Whereas for individuals who follow one tradition, one religious tradition, you can go about with one religion and one truth. So religion is an individual matter to make in a transformation on the individual level. So it's up to the individuals to choose which religion they want to follow. So according to their own mental predispositions, interest, and inclination, they should follow their own, whichever religion they wish to follow. So of course we cannot say everyone has to be Buddhist. Where Buddhism has flourished, we can say that is the main religion, but we cannot say even that everyone has to be religious practitioners as such. So several months ago, I saw one report where it was mentioned that there are about 1 billion people who are non-believers. So this is a fact today. So therefore, we need to respect the different followers of different religions has to respect one another. Whereas when it comes to talking about keeping faith, then you have to give faith in your own religion. So as a Buddhist, when I was in Tibet, I didn't have much contact with other religions, traditions as such, different religions. In Lhasa, there were many Muslims. So we lived very harmoniously. They lived like other Tibetans, any other Tibetan. So around the 17th century, during the 5th Dalai Lama's time, he gave some land for the Muslims to build their mosque. So he respected the Muslims, the Islam. And therefore, the Muslims could follow their own religious tradition. There were very few Muslims in Tibet, and then there were a couple of Christians as well when we were in Tibet. And then after coming into exile, I came in contact with different religious traditions, like Christians. And as I said earlier, I have many friends, Christian friends, who sincerely practice their own religion. They practice contentment and kindness, and they are very ethical, moral. And there are these kind of people, even in the amongst the Muslims and Jews. So there are people who are serving other people, genuinely serving other people, and their faith comes through their own religion. And so all the religious traditions are beneficial to people, and therefore I always endeavor to build religious harmony. So today I wish to say that we need to be harmony and respect other religions. And then there are people who are non-believers. So they are humans. They don't want suffering and want happiness like us. They're the same. And then 1 billion is quite a big number. So we should not discriminate against them, saying that they are non-believers, but we should have the feeling of oneness of humanity. In Buddhism, we talk about all sentient beings. We are praying for the benefit of all sentient beings. And so, in practical terms, we need to have this sense of oneness of humanity on this earth. And so even the non-believers, to have a better life, happier life, happier state of mind, is important. And so, even for them, morality is important, and the root of morality is kindness, good heart, warm heart. So whether you are a believer or non-believer, it is important to have a good heart, a warm heart. So the more warm heart they are, they would have better confidence and less fear and anxiety. And when there is no courage, then there is more anxiety and fear, and therefore stress builds up. And that disturbs their mental peace of mind. And then there is disturbance in the family and community. And so happiness is a state of mind, an experience that is within our mind. External objects, inanimate objects, do not have that experience as such. And therefore, we have to know this happiness is a feeling, that is an experience within us. So suffering, which we do not want, is also something, an experience that is within the mind. So whether we have all the necessary conditions or not, the external conditions or not, but if we could build up an internal environment, the correct environment, then we will have happiness. So whether you are a very wealthy person or not, if that kind of environment is not within, then you will not be happy. So, of course, non-believers can leave any kind of faith aside. They can ignore faith. But for peace of mind and happiness, the root of it is warm-heartedness. So we are not talking about trying to fulfill this goal of happiness or warm heart through prayers. Today, scientists, brain scientists, as well as health scientists, say that if you are more relaxed in mind, then you will have better physical health as well. So all of us do not want suffering and do not want we want happiness and we want good health and not unhealthy body. So the most important thing is to build a happy mind. So in Buddhism, Buddha himself has given teachings in accordance with the various predispositions of his disciples, the followers. So as this is the case with Buddhism, if the Buddha were to appear today in this world, then he would give certain instructions or advice to those who are non-believers as well. He wouldn't have imposed to them that they should follow the path to liberation that he has taught before and so forth. But
somebody else to the channel,
So in accordance with the mental dispositions of the different followers, he has given the different philosophical teachings of the philosophical schools, and also in accordance with the vastness of their attitude there, he has given these different teachings. And therefore, in today's world, it is very important to have a secular ethics, as I always think about it, and also tell this everywhere I go. Wherever I go, I always feel that I'm meeting other people. I do not feel that I am a Buddhist or a Tibetan or a Dalai Lama. I always talk on the level of being a human being. So if we have this attitude of seeing that I'm a Buddhist, I'm Asian, and so forth, then it'll automatically create a barrier between yourself and others. So that demarcation keeps ourselves distant from others. And then when it increases more and more, then you feel lonely. So when you feel this, when you are lonely, when you have this loneliness feeling, then of course, as humans, we are all social animals. But if we have to live alone like that, then this is against our nature of being a human social animal. And therefore, it's very important to have this human feeling amongst ourselves. Do you agree with me? Do you? Some of you are shaking your heads, some are nodding. So this is our responsibility of all of us. So we are part of the 7 billion people on this earth, and then we are follower of the teaching of the Buddha. So it's important for us to think about the humanity as a whole. So if the humanity is happy, then you as an individual would be happy automatically. There's no doubt. If humanity as a whole is unhappy, then you will also suffer. So we are gathered here once today, and then after this teaching, you'll be going back to your own, back home, to your own places. So regardless of what religion or a race or nationality and so forth, we are all same.
I want to tell you, I have been to Thailand.
In 60s, and I think 70s, I think few occasions I have been Thailand. So Thailand, the modernization, material sort of development, impressively sort of increasing, very good, wonderful. But meantime, the material value, there is limitation. The peace of mind, and from the Buddhist viewpoint, wisdom, prajna, wisdom, no limitation. For example, altruism, warm-heartedness, no limitation. We can increase infinitely. And prajna, human wisdom, also you see, can develop infinitely. From the Buddhist viewpoint, this very mind can become Buddha's mind. Material value, always there is limitation. So it is for material development is concerned, because there is limitation, so better to content in a certain level. Okay, Now sufficient food, sort of a comfortable sort of shelter, and happy society. Okay. Now, you want try to become millionaire. Once you become millionaire, still try to become billionaire. And you become billionaire, but still want more and more and trillionaire. Even then, the money alone will not bring inner peace. More money, more greed, and jealousy. Jealousy brings distrust, suspicion. Clear? So material development, necessary. We have this body, so we need some facility, bring physical comfort. It is very important. We must fight for, against poverty. Yeah, we must fight. A lot of people on this planet. The problem due to poverty. And then millions of young children, malnutrition. Still, we need more material development. However, if all our energy, all our mental energy, physical energy, only concentrate on material value, and then it is quite unfortunate. We have this marvelous sort of human intelligence. So we must utilize this marvelous intelligence, some deeper values. So here, Buddha Dharma, of course, I am Buddhist, so some of my explanation may have some prejudice there. Little prejudice maybe. But I feel now some scientists really showing genuine interest about Buddhist sort of psychology, Buddhist explanation, Buddhist knowledge about mind, about emotion, and Buddhist experience, how to tackle these emotions. Number of signs. Top scientist now really showing interest like that. So therefore, we Buddhists, 1,000 years, we already have using these knowledge already there. So use these sort of, study these things, then use our daily life and within our family and in our society. Here I always make distinction, Buddhism and Buddhist culture. Buddhism related with individual, personal. Buddhist culture related with society. So like Tibetan Muslim, their religion is Islam. But their way of life very much in the spirit of Buddhist culture. Buddhist culture, non-violence. And peace. And basis of peace and non-violence is compassion. So Buddhist culture, we can say culture of love, culture of compassion, isn't it? So irrespective whether you see individually, believer or non-believer, believe this religion, that's individual business. Society, as a society, I think non-violent culture, compassionate culture is something very relevant. So it is important to make distinction, Buddhist culture, like Western nations, Christian culture. Among them, some Muslims, some different sort of followers, some following different faith there, and non-believer also there. But it's a whole society, Christian culture, Judo-Christian culture, isn't it? Like that. Now Tibetan. Switch.
Now, only,
So over 2,000 years ago, there were people who said that Mahayana was not a teaching of the Buddha. And then many Tibetan Indian masters have actually written texts wherein they have actually argued for Mahayana being the teaching of the Buddha. And so even today we have such people who say that Mahayana is not teaching of the Buddha. And especially within Mahayana, there are the causal vehicle and the perfection vehicle and then the Vajrayana vehicle. And so there are people who have in the past also said that Tantra is not Buddhist. So, of course, we have different terminology that we use, like secret mantrayana or vajrayana. We should not just leave it at that, just the name, but we have to check the content of these teachings. So Buddha himself has said one should not rely just on the person, but on the teaching. And within the teaching, not on the words, but the meaning. And within meaning, not the interpretables, but the definitive ones. And then within the definitive ones, don't rely on the ordinary understanding, but on the wisdom understanding. And so the reason why the Buddha has said these is because he himself has said that, monks and scholars, just as gold is tested, likewise you should examine my teaching and then accept it, but not out of your devotion to me. And so the Buddha says that my followers, the monks and scholars, you should not accept my teaching just because you have devotion and faith in me, but you should use reason and investigate the teaching and then apply it and within yourself to test my teaching. And then when you find it to be my teaching is to be beneficial, then you should accept it. And therefore, Master Nagarjuna and so forth, the great Nalanda masters, have investigated the teaching of the Buddha. And they have not just accepted the teaching of the Buddha literally just because it was given by the Buddha, but they actually checked whether the teachings themselves go against reason, that could be undermined by reason and logic or not. And so when they found that they are not undermined by logic and reason, then they said that such teachings should be accepted literally. Whereas even within the teaching of the Buddha, for example, the Buddha says that the five aggregates are the loads, and then the person, a being, is the carrier of this load. So when we talk about somebody carrying a load, the load and the person are different. So this condition of the Buddha seems to be showing that there is a separate person, a being, who is separate from the loads, the psychophysical aggregates. So if you just say, this must be accepted, that there is a separate person, then the aggregates, just because it is the teaching of the Buddha, the words of the Buddha, then Buddha also has said that there is no self at all. And he has also said that there is no self, that there is selflessness. And then we would also have to accept that too. So it goes. And then in another sutra, the Buddha has said that these five psychophysical aggregates are empty, therefore there is no self. And so which one do we accept now? The previous quotation, although is the words of the Buddha, but we can find that there's logical inconsistency in this kind of teaching. And therefore we cannot accept it literally. Whereas in the second quotation, where the Buddha says that the psychophysical aggregates are empty, therefore there is no self, is not undermined by logic, and so it's not against reason and logic, therefore we can accept it literally. And then within the Buddhist philosophical school, there are the realists, the Chittamatras, the mind-only school, and then the Madhyamakas, the middle-way school. So if we compare these two, both these philosophical thoughts were taught by the Buddha. In the Sandinimocana Sutra, the Buddha has taught that there is no external phenomena. So now we have to check these teachings by checking whether they are against reason or not. They can be undermined, invalidated by reason or not. So if we accept everything that the Buddha has taught literally, then we would be full of contradictions. And therefore, it's very important to do investigation through reason. So even in the case of the word teaching of a Buddha, in the Sanskrit tradition, mainly following the Nalanda masters, the Nalanda scholars, so they actually use reason to prove the truth of the teachings of the Four Noble Truths. So, of course, reason brings about inferential cognition, but that inferential cognition must get back to some direct experience or perception as well. And therefore, there is these three categorization of the knowable objects into three things, which are the obvious manifest objects, and then slightly hidden, and then this very hidden phenomena. So with regard to the third category of phenomena, which is the extremely hidden phenomena, we need to resort to the authority of the Buddha's words. But in order to come to that conclusion, we need to check whether there is some contradiction through reason with regard to the teachings which teach about the slightly hidden phenomena, which is to say that those things which we should come to conclusion through inferential cognition. And then there are those things which are obvious to sensory perceptions as well. And so most scientists are focus on what is obvious so far, but in recent times the scientific field or research field also has slightly changed. So we can have good discussions with scientists with regard to what is obvious, what are the obvious things, and also slightly phenomena. And so those, what reasons do they do? Those who object that Mahayana is not the teaching of the Buddha. And we need to check the subject matter of the teachings. For example, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, let's say that it's not the teaching of the Buddha. If we reject that, then it will be very difficult for us to prove through reason the Four Noble Truths. So we would only have, we would only be left with the scriptural quotations. So it's very obvious that we find detailed and thorough explanation of the Four Noble Truths in the Mahayana Sutras, the teachings. And then Tantra, we should also check the content of Tantra. We need to investigate what is found in Pali tradition, and then in the Sanskrit tradition, and then what is said in the Tantric texts. So within the Sanskrit tradition, there are those sutra teachings and the Tantra teachings. So we need to compare and contrast between these teachings and then see If we do that comparison, then we'll see that there is a Buddhist Tantra teaching by the Buddha. So to prove liberation and omniscience, that it's possible to attain these, the reason we need to resort, we need the teaching of Mahayana. And then in the, with regard to omniscient state, we need to also understand what are the four Buddha kayas of the Buddha. So otherwise, we won't be able to explain the Buddha who appeared 2,600 plus years ago. So in the Mahayana teachings, we find mention of the Svabhavakaya, Jnanakaya, and then the Sambhogakaya. So Svabhavakaya, Jnanakaya, and Sambhogakaya, and then Nirmanakaya, when we can explain these, we have to explain it to, on the basis of what brings about the, what are the causes for these four Buddha bodies. So the compounded Buddha bodies have their causes and conditions. Within the causes, there are those which are the substantial causes, the primary matter. And then there are those of the contributing factors. And so if we look into Tantra, we can understand them very precisely, and then we'll be able to come to the conclusion that, oh, these four Buddha bodies are something which are possible for us to attain. Otherwise, we would only have to resort to some scripture. And so these ascertainments should come about through reason. And the more reason you use, the more certainty you will find. So the Master Tsongkhapa, who lived in the 14th and 15th centuries, he was a great scholar. This can be seen from his own writings. And he has seen that do not be contented with partial understanding of the writings of the six ornaments and two sublime masters, but one should have study all the texts very widely. And then Jerembuche also has said that one has to find a very firm certainty about the key points of the teaching of the Buddha by training one's mind in the eyes of reason. And so in order to do such investigation into the teaching, we need to know what are the means of investigating the teachings. And then we will see them, these means, in the writings of the six ornaments and these two sublime masters, or the 17 Nalanda masters, of whom I have written the praise. And so we'll find that they have done great investigation, examination into the teaching of the Buddha through reason. And so we need to follow that path and understand them, and then also use these reasonings and logic that they have used in relation to what is found today through science, scientific investigations as well, and then compare them. And so today I tell everyone that we need, as Buddhists, we need to be 21st century Buddhists. So the Chinese Buddhists have this tradition of making offering of a red envelope, something in a red envelope, to some masters and saying, Amitabha, Amitabha. That's not sufficient. And then the Lama. So if you find a Lama who says, bring me more of those red envelopes, I will lead you to liberation, then he or she is a liar. So it's very important for us to study this text. So of course, faith is important, which is very precious, but we should develop a faith which is based on reason. and not blind faith and say, I take refuge in the Buddha and so forth. So it's very important for you to study.
I'm telling
Buddhist. Now, we Buddhists should be 21st century Buddhist. We should not contend, our family, Buddhist family, so I'm following Buddha Dharma. If someone asks, what is Buddha Dharma? Then answer, I don't know. Many occasions, Buddhist community in the Himalayan range, so when I meet these people and I'm asked, you are Buddhist, are you Buddhist? They say Buddhist. And then I ask, what is Buddhism? They say, oh, Buddham Shanam Gacchami, Dhammam Shanam Gacchami, Sangham Shanam Gacchami, that's Buddhism. Then I told them, yes, that's right. What is Buddha? No answer. What is Dharma? No answer. And then also, you see, I ask whether there is differences Buddha and Vishnu or Brahma. They say no differences. Difficult. So this clearly shows lack of knowledge, full of knowledge, because lack of study. We simply, you see, content chanting something and pray without sort of without much sort of study. That's, I think outdated. That's old-fashioned. Now we must be a Buddhist with full knowledge about Buddhism. Not only we Buddhist, but also other sort of follower of different religions. They also, I think, must pay some sort of study, full of knowledge, particularly the Hindu, Jains, a lot of philosophical sort of views there. A lot of quite very rich, sophisticated philosophy. So study is very, very important, very important.
So as everyone knows, this is the mantra of the Heart Sutra. So this is called the mantra of the mantra Dharani of. So in the Heart Sutra, we find mention of this mantra being the mantra of. It says that the mantra is above the perfect wisdom, the mantra of the great knowledge, the mantra of unexcelled mantra, the mantra unequal to none, equal to none, equal, the mantra of that quells all suffering and so forth. So this is the Dharani of Heart Sutra. The Dharani mantra. So with regard to the Vajraparamita, the lady perfection of wisdom, there are several different aspects. One is yellow and with four hands, and then another one is yellow with one face, two hands, and so forth. So in any case, the mantra means, that yatha means it is like this. And gati means to go, to proceed or to go or to proceed. And then when you used it in imperative case, as an imperative case, then it means go. And so gate means go, or to go, and to go. And paragate means to go beyond. So go beyond. And Parasangate means go perfectly beyond. And Bodhi Swaha means, Bodhi means enlightenment, Swaha refers to laying the foundations of, laying the foundation of the Buddha enlightenment. So what it means, the mantra means is, at this time, we are bound by suffering and negative emotions. So when you have this strong determination to be free from the suffering and the suffering, and when you have this genuine sense of wanting to go out of this condition, then you have reached the first gate. So here you have this great strong and wish to be free from this bondage of the suffering and the negative emotions. And when you have a very firm determination to reach there, a genuine sense of wanting to be to reach that freedom, yes, you have cultivated the first path to enlightenment, which is gati, the part of accumulation. And then these negative emotions, which bind us and which cause us suffering, when you develop the wisdom, realizing emptiness, which is helped by single-pointed concentration, and you develop, therefore, this wisdom of wisdom realizing emptiness in a meditative state, then you reach the path of preparation, which is represented by the second gate. So at this point, we are ordinary beings. We have not reached the supramundane or the transcendent level, so we are in this mundane level. And so compared to the supramundane level, or the path of the Arya beings, we are in the ordinary level. And then So by the paragati means that refers to the path of seeing, which is to say that you reach the state beyond this mundane level, wherein you have ignorance and all these negative emotions. And when you reach the path of seeing, you overcome certain negative emotions, which are to be overcome by the path of seeing. And So when you develop this path which sees emptiness directly, that serves as an antidote to the those negative emotions which are to be overcome by the path of seeing. And therefore you reach the path which is supramundane path, and which is beyond this ordinary level. And so you reach the Arya, the state of an Arya being. And then when you still continue with your practice and proceed further, you reach the level of the part of meditation, which is to say that you familiarize further with this realization of the emptiness, direct realization of emptiness, and to overcome the negative emotions that are to be overcome by that path. And you reach the path of meditation, which is represented by Parasamgati. And then Bodhi means enlightenment. So in connection with the Mahayana path, what you have with regard to Bodhi is the Buddhahood. So you have this determination to reach Buddhahood for the benefit of sentient beings. And therefore, once you develop this path, the bodhicitta within yourself, you have reached the Mahayana path of accumulation, and then you proceed further and further. And then you reach the path of the Mahayana path of preparation, wherein you have the experience of meditative experience of the emptiness. And then parasamgati, when you reach the level of paragati, which is the path of seeing, you have attained the first bodhisattva ground. And then you go through the bodhisattva grounds. During these bodhisattva, 10 bodhisattva grounds, you develop the antidote to the negative emotions, and then from the 8th ground to the 10th ground, you have overcome. By the time you reach the 8th ground, you have overcome all the negative emotions, and then the last three bodhisattva, during the last three bodhisattva grounds, 8th, 9th, and 10th, you actually develop this antidote to the obscuration to knowledge. And so when you recite, as you recite the Heart Sutra and think about the meaning, what it shows is that you cannot just be passive, you need to make a journey, and not just physical journey, but a journey within your mind to proceed along the path, and so it helps, doesn't it? And so when we talk about doing Dharma practice, it's about making progress within the mind and progressing towards the omniscient state of Buddhahood, wherein there are the four Buddha bodies, and you go you reach closer and closer to that as you go along the path. So the Vajraparamita teachings, where the Four Noble Truths are explained still further in great detail, to attain that goal, what you need is the wisdom of emptiness, wisdom realizing emptiness, which is indispensable to overcome all our defilements that are within the mind. And then you also, the Vajraparamita teachings also teach us to cultivate bodhicitta. And Dhammakirti has said that love and so forth, since these kind of aspirational states of mind, since they do not go diametrically against to the distorted views like self, grasping at the self, independent self, they cannot overcome, uproot this. So sometimes when you have very strong sense of I, then you will have this determination to reach Buddhahood with that sense. And so sometimes there is saying that the grasping at the selfhood in persons is like the lineage of the Buddha. So with regards to love and faith, they could be afflicted ones. And so they could be affected by this grasping at some true existence in things and self. And so in order to overcome this uprooted, the actual means which actually goes directly against is the wisdom realizing emptiness. And so to overcome even the stains left by these negative emotions, you need the wisdom realizing emptiness. And so for both the negative emotions as well as the stains left by them, we have only one antidote, which is the wisdom realizing emptiness. But without the help of, without being complemented by bodhicitta and the six perfections, you cannot develop this antidote to the obscuration to knowledge, this cognitive obscuration, which is the main obstacle to attain omniscient state of Buddhahood. And therefore, to reach Buddhahood and to overcome these stains as well, we need bodhicitta to complement the wisdom realizing emptiness. Both are needed. And so with regards to the practice of bodhicitta, we have this text written by Master Shantideva. And first he wrote the Shiksha Samuchaya, where he has compiled many different quotations from different sutras. And then after that, he wrote Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, the guide to the Bodhisattva way of life. And so what we find, and wherein he has used much reason, and so what is not elaborated in one text is elaborated in the other, between these two texts. And so in the Kadampa tradition, they used to use six texts, and two of these are Bodhisattvacharya Avatara and Shiksha Samuchaya, the compendium of practice. And so with regard to Bodhisattvacharya Avatara, the ninth chapter focuses on emptiness, and then the rest of the nine chapters teach the other perfections. And Master Nagarjuna's Ratnavali, Jewel Garland, teaches the cultivation of bodhicitta through the means, which is the technique called equalizing, exchanging self and others. And so accordingly, Shantideva uses that technique for cultivating bodhicitta here in the eighth chapter and of Guide Bodhisattva Way of Life. And then with regard to the view of emptiness, the philosophic view of emptiness, Shantideva follows Master Nagarjuna's system of Prasangika Madhyamaka, following the explanations of Buddhapalita, Master Buddhapalita, and then also Master Chandrakirti, who have interpreted explained Master Nagarjuna's view very precisely and thoroughly. And so the ninth chapter shows the teaches the very subtle emptiness. And so 2 years ago, we started the teaching on Bodhisattvacharya Avatara. And of course, we could since we couldn't finish the whole book in the first year, we thought of doing it part by part. And so, last year, we finished in chapter 6 last year, and we are now on. So, Last year, I gave the oral transmission, the reading transmission of the seventh chapter. And so, the main explanation this time would be from the eighth chapter. And with regard to the seventh chapter, since I have not explained it, I wish to explain, give a summary of the seventh chapter. So the 10 chapters of Bodhisattva Charyavatar. Maybe I should see like this first. Bodhicitta, this altruistic intention to become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings. With regard to that, you have compassion, which observes sentient beings, and with wisdom, you focus on enlightenment. So by focusing on the sentient beings, the suffering sentient beings, you feel to liberating them from suffering. And so with compassion, you do that. And so in order to eliminate the suffering of others, the best means by which you can do that is by giving teachings. So the Buddhas can only do that, not merely through by showing miracles or giving some blessings. The Buddhas are not able to overcome or eliminate the sufferings of sentient beings. So the Buddhas do not wash away the sins of sentient beings, nor do they pick out the take out the sufferings of sentient beings, nor do they transpose their realization into the sentient beings. But only by teaching the truth, they help sentient beings. And so how do the Buddhas help if he does not help the sentient beings through the first three ways? So suffering comes because of ignorance and confusion about the reality of things. And therefore, in order to have overcome suffering, we need to understand the reality as it is. And through that, we can overcome the distorted view about reality and overcome suffering. So by showing what is right and what is wrong, the Buddha helps to eliminate our ignorance about what is right and wrong. And so this is the only means by which the Buddhas can help sentient beings to go out of suffering and its causes. And so Buddhism does not believe in a creator God. It's not a theistic religion where there's belief in a creator God, the suffering and happiness of sentient beings being created by God and so forth. So suffering and so forth do not come without causes, nor do they come from some unchanging cause, permanent cause. And so in Buddhism, what is said is suffering comes from ignorance. And so ignorance is twofold. Ignorance about causality and ignorance about the final reality of things. And so, by overcoming this ignorance, this is the only means to overcome suffering. So when you have this wish to help other sentient beings, because of your compassion, we need to know what actually brings sentient beings out of suffering. Therefore, you need to turn your mind to enlightenment, and you have to find that this is a possibility for you to attain, and therefore you understand that enlightenment is something possible to attain, and therefore you think of the helping other sentient beings out of suffering, and then you also have to build up this determination to work to become a Buddha for the benefit of sentient beings. And therefore, you need to also overcome suffering. And so with compassion, You feel the sentient beings, you want to liberate the sentient beings to be free from suffering, and you feel them dear to yourself. And therefore, through the practice of equalizing and exchanging self and others, you develop this sense of holding others to be dear, dearer than yourself. So when you hold others to be dearer than yourself, then it will help you and others temporarily and in the short term as well as long term. And therefore, if you remain selfish, it will not neither help you nor others, but you suffer. And therefore, you need to develop this, develop cherishing others and reducing self-cherishing attitude. And so, with regard to the suffering, Buddha has said in the Four Noble Truths, and so one needs to know what suffering is and overcome the origin of suffering. And so, of course, the suffering that we know as something unwanted, physical discomfort and mental discomfort, which is something obvious to us as being suffering, this is also understood by even animals as being unwanted. And so within Buddhism, we talk about three types of suffering, which are painful suffering, which even animals are aware of. And then there is the second type, which is called the changeable suffering. So within this comes those of the contaminated pleasurable experiences as well. And so those non-Buddhist practitioners even find these to be something which, such as the desire realm, called sensual experiences of desire realm, as well as the form and formless realms. And so the non-Buddhist practitioners who really practice asceticism and live in solitude, they also find these sensual pleasures of desire realm to be something kind of an obstacle, and they also renounce these, and then absorb themselves in concentration. Whereas in the case of what the Buddha has said, know what is suffering. So this refers primarily to the, for example, this aggregates and the birth, which comes through the force of karma and delusions. Such a state of birth is called, and the body and mind are called, the suffering, which is the pervasive existential suffering. So to be free from this, now, this kind of body and mind, come through our karma and delusions, and therefore, in order to sever the continuity of such a condition of birth, we need to sever the origin of suffering. And therefore the Buddha has said, no suffering and overcome the origin of suffering. Now, when you overcome the origin of suffering, which must be done in a gradual manner, and therefore the Buddha has said that cessation must be attained. And so one needs to start with the very coarse level of suffering, origin of suffering, and then go into eliminating the more subtle ones, and then finally overcome all the negative emotions and reach liberation. And not only that, we also need to reach omniscient state by even overcoming the residual stains left by those negative emotions. And therefore, in Buddhahood, you have reached a state whereby you are free from both the obscurations of afflictions and their stains. And therefore, the suffering must be known, as the Buddha says, is very important. And so in all the teachings, in many teachings of the Mahayana and lesser vehicle, we have the teachings on the Four Noble Truths. And then we have the practice of the establishing mindfulness, within which there are four: mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mind, and phenomena. And when I was in Thailand in the past, I saw in some monasteries they have kept dead bodies from which are one day or just a freshly dead body, and then dead bodies which are 1 day or 1 week and so forth old. And so these help to build up mindfulness. So with regard to suffering, the truth of suffering, we have four distorted views about it, which are holding on to this impermanent thing as being permanent, and this filthy body as being pure and clean, and and then this suffering nature as being something pleasurable and so forth. And so we have this mindfulness of the body, and then the mindfulness of feelings or sensations. So because of our attachment to pleasurable feelings and we have attachment, and because of our aversion to the unpleasurable ones, we have hatred. So if you watch this mind that goes through such experience of pain and pleasure, what is it? And so a mind, this consciousness, it has a continuity, and therefore it has parts, momentary parts to it. We are attached to pleasant experiences, and we averse unpleasant ones. So when we have these two experiences of pleasure and pain, they seem to have some kind of objective existence, some kind of permanence. And so when we think about pain and pleasure, we have to think in terms of the mind. And the mind itself has a continuity, and it has moments to it. And so in each moment, you will not find that pain and pleasure. So by focusing or developing this mindfulness of the mind, we enter into the cessation, and therefore the person who reaches that goal is also designated on the basis of the continuity of mind. And so in Buddhism, as long as you hold on to some kind of absolute or objective eye, it has to be somewhere within the body and the mind, but this is not findable. And so in Buddhism, we talk about a person being a continuity of the basis of the mind. Continuity of the mind, we designate a person. Although we have this notion that there is some kind of a self, But if you were to really find that, you need to be able to find that in within this continuity of the consciousness, whereas you cannot find it. And therefore, this the in connection with the we have this teaching on selflessness. And therefore, by familiarizing our mind with the selflessness, we can actually reach the true cessation, or wherein all the negative emotions have dissolved. And therefore, we have the mindfulness of phenomena, wherein we learn that certain things are to be adopted for our practice of the path, and certain things are to be discarded. And therefore, if you think about these, then think about these four mindfulness practices, then you will also have this determination to develop what are known as the four abandonments. And then, in order to develop the path within ourselves, whereby you have a very stable state of mind, you need to also, you'll find that you need to develop single-pointed concentration. And therefore, you have the other sets of practices within the 37 harmonies to enlightenment, such as the five forces and five powers, the five faculties and five forces, and then the sevenfold path and so forth, eightfold path. And therefore, the 37 harmonies of enlightenment are very important as well. And then, in the Mahayana teachings, Mahayana scriptures, to recognize the suffering that we explained earlier, and also to see that suffering sentient beings and wanting them to be out of suffering, and then we develop the rest of the path to reach enlightenment, Buddhahood. And therefore, you need to develop the aspirational state of mind, which aspires to Buddhahood, the omniscient state. And so you will, then having developed the aspirational bodhicitta, then you will develop this wish to hold the practices of bodhisattvas to be like your own life force, and then you take the bodhisattva vows as well, and you have the venturing bodhicitta. So you need to reflect on again and again on the benefit of bodhicitta. So you'll find the bodhicitta brings about the temporary as well as long-term goals, and so higher rebirth and the reaching definite goodness or liberation or omniscient state also comes through bodhicitta. So it can fulfill one's own goal as well as the goals of others. And therefore, so this kind of infinite altruistic state of mind, if we are able to develop it, we will see how precious it is. And and therefore, you make this pledge to keep the bodhicitta and develop, having developed bodhicitta and made such pledge, and so we have the practice of the seven limbs, which comes in the third chapter of Bodhisattva Charyavatara, and then the in order to overcome the negativities that we have accumulated, we have this second chapter, which is the chapter on confession. And then the third chapter also continues with the seven limbs. And then it comes to the point of generating bodhicitta. So perhaps we'll have time in day after tomorrow for this. For generating bodhicitta. So having generated bodhicitta, then we have this. We do the practice of the six perfections. So of these six perfections, the perfection of giving is found in the 10th chapter and others, where you give your body, you intend to give your body and life and so forth. And so there's no separate chapter for this the practice of perfection of giving. And then the perfection of morality, we have the chapters on conscientiousness and guarding alertness, 4th and 5th chapter. And so just as when we are sick, we would listen to the advice of the doctors who tell us not to take such and such diet and avoid such and such diet and take such and such things, and we would be very mindful, careful about what we eat and drink. And then if you drink too much, you become totally uncontrolled. And therefore, so because alcohol causes lots of other problems, therefore it is recommended to avoid alcoholism. So as Buddhists, you should think that I'm a follower of the Buddha. You remind yourself of it. And then in your daily life, you should remind yourself of this, and you should feel that you should follow the advice of the Buddha. So when you meet with some conditions whereby you may harm others, you should remind yourself of being a Buddhist and avoid harming others. So recently when the conflict in Burma happened, some people have asked me, interviewed me, and during those interviews I have said that those people who meet with the Muslims in Burma, when they tend to harm the Muslims, the Buddhists, when they tend to harm the Buddhists, they should remind themselves of the face of the Buddha. Remember the face of the Buddha. And so you should think that I will do whatever I do, I will do them in accordance with the wish of the Buddha. And so there are the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the three times who have unsurpassed, unexcelled understanding and wisdom. So we cannot hide what we do from them because they have this omniscient mind. And so show conscientiousness by reminding yourself that whatever I do, they are obviously seen by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And then as monks and nuns and bhikshus, and you should remind yourself of being monks and nuns and bhikshus, and even in dreams you should be able to restrain yourself. And then and so we have the chapter on conscientiousness, and then so to keep morality pure, you have the practice of conscientiousness, being heedful, and then next is the 5th chapter, which is guarding alertness or introspection. So whether you're a lay person or just because you are a Buddhist, You should know what are to be practiced and what are to be avoided. What is right and wrong with regard to your body, speech, and mind. There are those 10 non-virtuous actions which need to be avoided, and so you should show mindfulness in this. And then, whenever you meet with some condition where you might go against those precepts, you might indulge in the misdeeds, you should remind yourself of this being not good, and then avoid, refrain yourself from doing it. And so, Master Shantideva is said to have taught this to a group of assembly of monks. During one of the bi-monthly confession sessions, and therefore he goes through the monks' vows, what they need to avoid and so forth. Of course, they may not apply to the lay people as such, and so the monks should know for the Mula Sarvastivadin tradition followers, they should remind themselves of the 253 vows of monks, and they should remind themselves whether they are they should be vigilant whether they are actually committing any of the infractions or not, and when they are about to do and commit them, they should avoid. And so to keep morality pure, you have these two chapters, conscientiousness and guarding alertness. And then, with regard to the perfection of patience, so in our practice of compassion, when what actually obstructs us from doing this is when others provoke us anger. Unjustly sometimes. And so in the practice of equalizing and exchanging self and others, the main obstacle is impatience, and therefore in this chapter there is teaching on the how to accept suffering and also not to be overcome by the agents causing harm and suffering. And then with regard to the perfection of joyous effort, so what we should know is that we are acquainted with the three poisons, the afflictive emotions. So we need to put effort to go against them. To develop the antidote, we need to put effort. They will not just come about just like that. And therefore, we have the practice of enthusiasm or joyous effort. So joyous effort is very important. And then we have the practice of concentration, which is taught in the 8th chapter, the meditation. And then the perfection of wisdom is taught in the 9th chapter. And so the Buddha gave teaching in a progressive manner, giving teachings first on giving, which is easier, and then the morality and so forth. And then when it comes to wisdom, there are also within this, there we have the perfection of power and perfection of skillful means and so forth. And with regard to enthusiasm or joyous effort, it means feeling glad to engage in certain, some virtuous practices. And so the obstacle to enthusiasm or joyous effort is laziness. Within which there is laziness, where you indulge in wrong things, and then there is laziness where you feel discouraged. So many of us actually spend much of our time in the first category of laziness. And then with regards to the cultivation of bodhicitta and the wisdom of emptiness and so forth, sometimes we feel that, oh, these are something which we cannot do, and we feel discouraged. And so this is the worst kind of laziness for us. So in the world today, where there are places where there is much material development, people are more or less lost in the material pleasure and development. When you see something beautiful, or hear some beautiful music, or you are able to use some kind of internet and have some entertainment, sometimes you feel that unless you have these things, you cannot kill your day. And so, and then there is some taste and smell, and also touch, tactile sensations, especially sexual bliss. And so, sometimes maybe I'm saying too much, but only focusing on material development alone, even as humans, is like being in an animal world. So where people are only focusing on experiencing the pleasant smell, sight, and sound, and so forth. Of course, you may be able to do some degree of analysis there, but then, unlike animals, we as humans, we have this marvelous intelligence, a powerful one, and without using this, just indulging ourselves with sensorial experiences, there is not much work to our mind. So, unlike animals, what we need to do as humans, having this marvelous intelligence, is we need not to, without relying on the sensory experiences, but using our mind itself with this human brain. If we are not able to use this, then we are like animals. So in Buddhism, we talk about higher states of rebirth. So those who are lost only in material development and progress, they are like animals. Wisdom. So mainly we need, what I'm saying is we need to use our mind. And as Nagarjuna says in his jewel garland, or somewhere, and of course in those days in India there were many different religious traditions, and Nagarjuna says there are some religions which rely on purification practice by using the body, physical religions which use the body more, and then there are other religions which focus on the sound of the Vedas, and focusing their mind only on the, so using their ear consciousness, auditory consciousness, they listen to the sound of the Vedas. And so Nagarjuna mentions these types of religions that existed in India, and then he says Buddhism is about using the mind. So here we need to use our intelligence, critical faculty, and in order to use that without single-pointed concentration, it's also difficult. So we may do some prayers and make some wishes, but then our mind is immediately distracted, so it cannot stay on the object. And so this is, Arjuna says, using the mind in practicing religion is the more difficult one, and Buddhism is actually about it. And therefore, we need to show, the practice of joyous effort, perseverance. So if we let ourselves be carried away by our ordinary mind, body, and speech, then what will happen? So merely focusing on material development will not help, even in short term as well as in long term. When we die, nothing will help. No wealth, no amount of wealth and money will help. No amount of, however good relatives and parents you have, they will not help. However strong and powerful body you may have, this will not help at the time of death. And so what will help is the mind. So if here you need to think whether there is a continuity, a future continuity of the mind or not. Whether at death the mind will go become nil or not. And so in order to see whether there is a continuity of the mind in the future, future continuity of the mind, we need to see whether there is a continuity of the mind in the past. And so our body, of course, comes from our parents, their sperm and ovum, and then they too, their parents too, have come from their parents. And then, with regard to the body itself, if we break the body down into its particles, the continuity of these particles goes back a long time. And so, the body needs to have a compatible course to give rise to it. Not something which is permanent, unchanging, can give rise to these particles that form the body, nor the consciousness can be the substantial continuity of the body as such. And so similarly, with regard to the mind, the consciousness that we have, it is not material. It has this mere clarity or luminosity and awareness nature. And so its substantial cause must have these qualities. So just as some matter needs matter to give rise to it, matter needs a substantial cause, which is a matter. Likewise, consciousness needs a substantial cause, which is consciousness. And therefore, this consciousness that has just conceived in the mother's womb must have a previous moment, which is just before the conception in the womb. And therefore, there's nothing else we can say but that there must be this continuity of the consciousness before this life. And therefore, when we die, with regards to this consciousness, whether it will stop continuing. Of course, if something has a powerful counterforce which ends its continuity, then of course it will end. For example, if we have a distorted conception, it can be overcome by the conception or thought which sees reality. But this mere cognitive and clarity nature of the mind doesn't have anything which can end its continuity at all. And therefore, so if there is an obstacle, a counter force which can end this continuity of the mind, which is mere cognitive and clarity nature, then it will end. But there is no reason why it will end, because there is no such counter force. So amongst humans, we have people who remember their past lives, sometimes very clearly. I have met some of them, Indians, who remember their past lives very clearly and remember their past lives' parents and their names, and then relatives, brothers and sisters, and where they lived. And then the child, when they remember the past lives, they were able to even remember the things that belongs to them in the past life. And so we need to do some investigation into these facts, how these happen. So in Buddhism, we prove past and future lives on the basis of the continuity of mind. So without there being a substantial cause of consciousness, which is a consciousness, there cannot be past and future life. And therefore, we prove past and future lives on the basis of this continuity of consciousness. And therefore, when we die from this life, in this life, what will help is not your wealth, money, nor your body, your relatives and parents and so forth, but what will help is what actually influences us, affects us, is these, what the virtues that we have created in this life and past will help. So there is this practice or the action of refraining yourself from non-virtuous actions by using your body, speech, and also mind with good, kind thought. What happens is once you create this cause, it goes into this disintegration, and that disintegration of them continues further and further. And so what helps us at the time of death is those virtues, the disintegration of the virtues that we have left, will help if they are powerful, and if we have created left a very powerful disintegration of the non-virtues, then we will suffer in the next lives. And therefore, in this life, since we have found this human rebirth and also met with the teaching of the Buddha, and also you should feel that you should feel not to indulge in trivial kind of things, which only helps in this life alone and not beyond. And so since we have this mind, this intelligence, if we could create some virtues by using our mind, such as faith based on Buddha, focusing on the Buddha, and compassion in relation to sentient beings, and then develop this wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others, then this is a very powerful virtue that we create. So rather than taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha only with the wish to become liberated for yourself alone, and with the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings, and taking refuge in them, in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha with the wish to help other sentient beings. These two, the difference between these two is huge. The latter is much more powerful. And so if you could create a powerful, very powerful virtues within yourself, they will help to overcome negativities. Most of our negative actions are created with selfish attitude. So we cannot become angry focusing on all sentient beings as such. So the 10 non-virtuous actions that we create are mainly because of selfish attitude, whereas love and compassion are very states of mind where you have a very broad-mindedness. And so Master Shantideva has said in his Bodhisattva Avatara, said that we have this mind, and this continuum of mind of ours and the continuum of the mind of the Buddha, Shakyamuni, which is the mere cognitive and clear nature, is same. So just as the Shakyamuni Buddha has been able to attain all the powers and the qualities of Buddhahood, likewise we too, Shantideva says, have this potential to achieve those qualities. And therefore, we have this Buddha nature within ourselves, the Tathagata Garbha within ourselves. As long as we have this cognitive and clarity nature of the mind, since it has this nature of knowing things, therefore we have this potential to see everything as they are, the Tathagata Garbha. In the Sakya tradition, they talk about the unity of clarity and emptiness. And so they talk about this, the qualities of the Buddha, that the sentient beings have this potential for the qualities of the Buddha. So we need to be aware of this, and then have to develop this courage and put effort in attaining those goals. It's a matter of whether we put effort or not, with courage and determination and confidence. So someone who's just a kid, not knowing anything, starts learning the alphabet and then progresses further and further and then becomes a scholar, an expert in different fields. And so this comes through learning. And then someone who knows nothing, has no skills, can train and then become skilled in different fields. But these are only limit, they have some limit, because the physical training by which you become a very good athlete and so forth cannot become expert limitlessly as such. Because if they take a break for 1 or 2 months without doing an exercise and training, then they would have to put more effort later on to gain the same kind of skill back. Whereas the qualities that are developed on the basis of the mind itself have no limit. so such as wisdom, compassion, love, and so forth, can be increased limitlessly, infinitely. And so the qualities that are developed in the mind have this firm basis of the clarity and cognitive nature of the mind. And then once you become familiar, you don't need to put extra effort to have those experiences that you develop further and further. And therefore, we need to put effort. So sometimes we may be slackened to in our efforts, saying that, oh, I may be able to do this next day and so forth. So you need to overcome this kind of laziness of so since we have all kinds of negative emotions, we need to develop the vigilance and also know what are the different counteracting factors to these different negative emotions and accordingly apply them through effort. So one reason why we may feel discouraged while we try to practice Dharma is sometimes we would lack confidence in ourselves when we hear about the great, profound, vast practices of bodhisattvas, thinking that, oh, I may not be able to, would I be able to really practice them? You feel discouraged, feeling like that. So with regard to giving body and so forth, so the qualities that we can develop in the mind can infinitely increase. So with regard to something which may be difficult in the beginning, we need to go do some training from the doing it with starting with something which is easy, and then later on that thing which seemed difficult in the beginning will seem to be easier. For example, in my case, I had this feeling that in the beginning the bodhicitta is very difficult to develop, but then through familiarization and training and practice, then I could feel that it's easier to develop. So we need to think over and over again, and then we feel some taste. So from our very ordinary experience, if we could see such things possible, then we can also feel that those things which the great masters or the great beings have said in the past may be also possible. And so in the Lamde tradition, they go through these four valid things. Scripture, and then the exegetical treatises, and then the Lama, valid Lama, and valid experience. And so with regard to our own experience, it has that has to come first. And then from your experience, you will find that the Lama is a valid one, an authoritative one. And therefore, when you see the Lama to be a qualified one, You see that the texts, the commentarial texts, were the ones on which the Lama has relied, and therefore those texts would be found valid and authoritative. And then from through that, what we'll find is that the Buddha who gave the teachings, and as Master Nagarjuna says, I prostrate to the Gautama who, moved by his compassion, gives teaching, holy teaching, to rid us of all distorted views, and also his Nagarjuna's salutation verses of Mule Madhyamaka Karika show how the Buddha was a great being. And so, Nagarjuna regards the Buddha to be very holy one and sacred. Nagarjuna, who was not just an odd anybody, but who actually checked the teaching of the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha themselves, whether they can be literally accepted or not, and what are to be provisional and what are definitive and so forth. And when such a person finds the Buddha to be authoritative and valid, then you will be able to ascertain the Buddha as being someone authoritative. So with regard to the teaching on selflessness, you'll find arguments that are put against the self-grasping attitude as a valid, a very powerful means, and making the selfless, self-grasping attitude dumbfounded. And And therefore, through these, we can find that the Buddha's teaching is also valid and authoritative. And so the Buddha is said to have become someone who is authoritative. And therefore, when you find that the Buddha had become an authoritative person, you will also find that, oh, if that is the case, then maybe I could also become a Buddha in the end. And so you find some confidence in cultivating the path. So we need to train gradually, just as we go through the school system, where, of course, you cannot teach just a kindergarten child to become an astronaut right away. And so a child may not be able to grasp those big things that he or she learns later on, but through familiarization, things become familiar to you. As Shantideva says, there is nothing that cannot become familiar, that cannot become easier through familiarization. And so, sometimes there are people who, I mean, foolish people who may feel rather confident without really much reason. But what is important to understand is that through familiarization, things will become easier to us. So as I always quote this, which intelligent one would feel despair, would despair by riding the horse of bodhicitta, which takes one from bliss to bliss. So this, the powerful negative emotions and the cognitive obscurations that are powerful in us, when we see that they do not have any valid support from valid cognition, valid knowledge, then we would have this confidence to overcome it. And then you will, through your practice, you'll have some taste of this wisdom, and then you will have this determination to reach liberation and omniscience. And so, in your mind, you will also find that bodhicitta is the one thing that you will practice whether you are alive or at death or in the next lives. And so you should have such a strong single-pointed determination to make this your practice in this and future lives. And then in this chapter on the enthusiasm, there is some kind of a pride that are to be overcome, and then certain confidence which need to be developed, which is termed as pride. And so when you persevere like this, then you will always feel happy to, you'll have this physical and mental pliancy to engage in whatever virtuous practices you have to do. And so, now let's turn to chapter 8. So, verse 1, read. As I said earlier, this unruly mind, which is under the influence of, under the sway of negative emotions, and we are not only friends with these self-cherishing attitude and grasping at true existence, but we even consider them to be our rulers. We give in to them. So even in our dreams, we have this attitude of crushing others' happiness and crushing others, and always trying to have happiness for ourselves. So, self-cherishing attitude and grasping at true existence are our, have been our sole protector. We have relied on them so far. So what is the result of that now? So now what we should do is we should not give in to them. We need to confront them. It's not enough just to say, oh, it's bad. The self-cherishing attitude and grasping at true existence are bad. But we need to know what actually goes counter to them. Therefore, we need first to develop these counteracting factors where it has not yet been developed, and we need to enhance them once we have developed them. And so these counteracting factors of self-cherishing attitude and grasping a true existence must be developed, and therefore we must have this determination to develop it further and strengthen them. It doesn't help to have all kinds of furnitures in your home, making offerings and for making offerings and so forth. So Milarepa had nothing with him except some letters from Marpa, his master. He lived as a mendicant, and sometimes he put these letters of Marpa on his head. Sometimes what happens with us is we may have statues of Buddhas and so forth in our rooms, and then we may have paid, and they may be very expensive ones. And so sometimes when you have expensive statues and paintings of Buddhas and Buddhists and so forth, we almost regard them like our possessions. Like mundane possessions. And so we need to develop these positive qualities within us. In order for that, we need single-pointed consciousness, single-pointed concentration, without which we cannot stay, our mind cannot stay on one object in meditation. So, calm abiding or Singaporean concentration is something which is shared with non-Buddhist traditions. But without the single-pointed concentration, we cannot progress along the path and reach the higher attainments of the paths and grounds. So without single-pointed concentration, our mind, which is distracted, much distracted, is very much familiar and acquainted with the negative emotions. And so it says, having developed initiation, I should place my mind in concentration. For the person whose mind is distracted dwells between the fangs of disturbing conceptions. So we are distracted. On the one hand, we are distracted to the external things, and then our mind is also disturbed by these negative conceptions or emotions. And so we need physically to be isolated and from the worldly chores, and then our mind should be isolated from the negative emotions. And then in Thailand, there are forest monks who live in solitude. So here also in Dharamsala, we have monks who live in the mountains. In Tibet also, there were practitioners, meditators who lived isolated. So although you may be physically isolated, but if your mind is full of distractions, it doesn't help, and therefore you need to overcome these conceptions. So verse number 2 says that. And then verse number 3. So when you are attached to one's food, clothing, shelter, and relatives, parents, and so forth, then one has attachment, and that serves as an obstacle to one's meditation. And therefore, it shows the importance of solitude. And then next shows the cultivation of calm abiding. So the main purpose of developing this concentration is to have the wisdom realizing selflessness. So it says, having understood the disturbing conception is completely overcome by superior insight and dealt with calm abiding, first of all, I should search for calm abiding. This is achieved through the genuine joy of those unattached to world life. And then, because of the obsession, one transcendent being has for other sentient beings, transcendent beings, they will not see their beloved ones again for many thousands of lives. Verse number 6 also read. Verse number 7. 8. So if you only see the gaining on food, shelter, clothing, and so forth for this life alone, then you're wasting your life. There's no essence. And then if you live with others, you will not be able to engage in, they will serve as obstacles to your Dharma practice. So verse number 9 reads, so childish. In verse number 9:4 here, it mentions myself childish. So childish can be understood in terms of a child by age, and then in terms of people who cannot think about long-term benefits, just focusing on these temporary goals are childish. So you cannot be too attached to your friends and relatives. It says one moment they are friends and in the next instant they become enemies. Since they become angry even in joyful situations, it is difficult to please ordinary people. They are angry when something of benefit is said, and they also turn me away from what is beneficial. So if you acquaint yourself, associate all the time with people who only think about this life alone, then you too will be carried away by the preoccupations of this life alone. And then, moreover, the childish are like envious of superiors, competitive with equals, arrogant towards inferiors, conceited when praised, and if anything unpleasant is said, they become angry. Never is any benefit derived from the childish. And so, this is childish behavior. When you see someone lower than you, you kind of look down upon them. Or when someone equal, you feel competitive. And when someone is higher than you or better than you, you become jealous. So through associating with the childish, there will certainly ensue unwholesomeness, such as praising myself, belittling others, and discussing the joys of cyclic existence. So people who are silly, only lost in the pleasures of this life, should be avoided, and distance yourself from them. So devoting myself to others in this way will bring about nothing but misfortune, because they will not benefit me and I shall not benefit them. I should flee far away from childish people. When they are encountered, though, I should please them by being happy. I should behave well, merely out of courtesy, but not become greatly familiar. So you should behave with such people, such that when there is some opportunity to gain something, there's some advantage, you need to take them, but not be too familiar with them. In the same way as a bee takes honey from a flower, I should take merely what is necessary for the practice of Dharma, but remain familiar as though I had never seen them before. Verse number 17 shows that you should not be detached to the wealth and money and so forth. So with a firm mind, understand well that it is the nature of these things to be discarded. So however rich you may be or famous you may be, at the time of death, nothing will help. The verse number 21 says, if there is someone who despises me, what pleasure can I have in being praised? And if there is another who praises me, what displeasure can I have in being despised? So you should not be too happy when you receive praise, because there are others who despise you. And when others despise you, you should not be too dejected, because there are others who praise you. And then verse number 22, if even the conqueror was unable to please the various incarnations of different beings, then what need to mention a malicious person such as I? So during the time of the Buddha, of course, Buddha was not able to make everyone pleased. And so there were people who argued against him. Then, therefore, I should give up the intention to associate with the worldly. So one should not be too dependent on what others do or think about you. So you should be very firm, be yourself. As Kadampa masters have said, that you should put the tether on your own neck, not let others lead you. Scorn those who have no material gain and say bad things about those who do. How can they who are by nature so hard to get along with if ever derive any pleasure from me? And so what these shows is the antidotes to the attachment to one's near and dear ones and so forth. It has been said by the Tathagata that one should not befriend the childish, because unless they get their own, these children are never happy. And verse number 26 says, when dwelling in caves, in empty shrines, and at feet of trees, never look back, cultivate detachment. So you should not be preoccupied with the thought or attachment to what you have left behind. Then, when shall I come to dwell in places not to clung to mine as mine, which are by nature wide and open, and to where I may behave as I wish without attachment? So for monks, they should have what is allowed in the according to Vinaya, and their begging bowl and so forth. So they should not take too much pleasure in having expensive things with you, them. Tun Lama has criticized certain customs of the past lamas. He had said that in the past masters used to have short names, but long in they have very long. They are very tall in knowledge, whereas current lamas have long names, but they are short in knowledge. So we need to check ourselves, not to go against the intention of the Buddha. Whereas the Buddha has said monks and nuns are not allowed to have sleeves, wear sleeves, whereas Tibetans in the past, Tibetan lamas used to wear a very elaborate coat, jackets like Da Guozi, which were offered by Chinese emperors. So as I said earlier also, the Buddha used to live by begging for food, whereas we, as his followers, seem to have a whole household that belong to ourselves, our labdangs. So that's not a very good sign for the Dharma. And if you are a Lama, you should have very good knowledge and experience. of the Dharma. And without these, just having a big name and doesn't help. Otherwise, it would be like what the Toyon Lama has said, short and long name, but short and knowledge. Regarding myself, I have this long name. This is my long name. So, although I have a long name, but comparatively, I try to expand my knowledge day by day. So, although I may not be someone with with much knowledge, but I still try to gain more and more knowledge. Though I'm already 78, I still read texts and study the Dharma. And so, verse number 28, when shall I come to live without fear, having just a begging bowl and a few odd things, wearing clothes not wanted by anyone, and not even having to hide this body? So, with regards to the begging bowls and the clothing, for monks, we should not have very expensive ones to wear. In Tibet, we used to wear very elaborate and clothes. But since coming to exile, I have left them completely. And in the 13 things, titan items of monks, bhikshus, there is no mention of hat. Verse number 28 then. Jitamila Repa was living in his cave. One night, a thief came, and Nilarepa laughed at him because the thief was searching for things in his cave. And Milarepa laughed and said, "What can you find in my cave? Things that I cannot even find in the daytime." So he lived as a mendicant, like a beggar. In verse number 29, having departed to the cemeteries, when shall I come to understand that this body of mine, the skeletons of others, are equal in being subject to decay? So when you see those bones of others in the cremation grounds, you should remind yourself that you will also be like that in the end. Then because of its order, not even the foxes will come close to this body of mine, for this is what will become of it. So when we die, the body gives out a foul smell, and then there will be insects, and it will be stinging to such a degree that even animals who might want to eat some flesh cannot come nearby. So with these, when you meditate on these things, it will help to reduce your attachment to the body. Verse number 31. So if this, even this body were to be left behind, has to be left behind in the end, so what is use of your friends and wealth and so forth? And your fame. 32, finished. The two most important times in one's human life, a human being's life, is birth and death. But at these two times, if we can not do much, then what can we do in the in between? And so we find in Milarepa's biography, he has really used the Dharma practices to counter his negative emotions and so forth right away. So when you are traveling from one place to another, you are not going to stay there forever. And so there's not much reason why we should prepare so much, because we are in the end going to go from here. So it says, in the same way as travelers on the highway leave one place and reach another, likewise our life also goes by. I'm now 78 years old. As the 400 verses of Aryadeva says, what seems to be future seems to be very far away, but although we have such a conception, they just pass by. Verse 34, until the time comes to this, for this body to be supported by four pallbearers. So at the time of death, in any way we have to go from this life, leave everything behind. So while you have the opportunity to use this life in the proper way, you should seize this opportunity to practice virtue. So we are talking about Buddhist practitioners. So we need to work towards our goal of liberation and omniscience. And so in the end, what happens is we become a corpse. So it's a matter of day, but this day will definitely come, it's saying. Therefore, while you have the freedom to practice the path to liberation, the lasting goal of enlightenment, you should seize this opportunity. Befriending no one and begrudging no one, my body will dwell alone in solitude. If I am already counted as a dead man, while I die, there will be no mourners. And as there will be no one around to disturb me with this mourning, thus there will be no one to distract me from my recollection of the Buddha. And so you should isolate yourself and imbue your mind with the practice of the Dharma, so that your mind itself is called becomes the Dharma. So when you become familiar with these practices of wisdom realizing emptiness and bodhicitta, even in dreams you can dream of them. And therefore, I shall dwell alone, happy and contented, with few difficulties in very joyful and beautiful forest, pacifying all distractions, having given up all other intentions, by being motivated by only one thought. I shall strive to settle this mind in equipoise and to subdue it. So, renouncing the food, shelter, clothing, fame, and so forth, doesn't mean that you should not rely on them at all, but you should not run after them all the time, is the meaning here. So I'll stop here. Verse number 38 then. So review session will be from 1 or 1:30 There will be Gishil Tubden Pelsang La, who will do review session, a very good, excellent Gishila. So I have asked Tubden Pelsang to do the review for English listeners, and then for the Chinese, Yangden Rinpoche will do the review session. So if you have questions, both of them are Vinaya holders, and they know the essential points of the Vinaya practice. So since you have come here already, if you could use this time positively, it would be good. So if you could gain some more beneficial knowledge about Buddhism, if we could also discuss about these differences and similarities between Pali and Sanskrit traditions of Buddhism, it would be good.
Thank you.
1:30. Review session will be from 1:30. Yes. Review session.
Review session.
Yes.